Well, we finished our series on saving faith. This morning I'm going to preach just a one-off sermon, and it's from the Song of Solomon and chapter 8. The Song of Solomon may not be all that well known, but the text that we're looking at this morning is probably the best well known in the whole book. So it's chapter 8, verses 5 to 7, which I'll just read. Who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Under the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she who bore you was in labor. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love. Neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. I just want us to consider then these three verses for a few minutes this morning, and I would like us to do so under a couple of headings. And first of all then, a delightful clarity. A delightful clarity. Now, one of the things that you always need to do when handling a passage from the Song of Solomon is work out who is saying what within the passage. And with these verses then, in the first part of verse 5, we have the narrator, or better, the poet, because Song of Solomon is a collection of poems rather than a narrative. We have the poet speaking in that first part of verse 5 there. And the poet alludes in that first part of verse 5, you'll notice, to two individuals. These two individuals have been the main characters throughout the book. One is a male character, the other a female character, and they are lovers. And here in the first part of verse 5 then, there's a particular emphasis, you'll notice, on the female character. Who is that coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved? And so the poet is especially focusing on her, so that when in the next part of verse 5, there's a transition, you'll notice, to first person speech, we're probably meant to understand that this now is her talking. And indeed that the rest of our text then this morning is her talking. So I hope you're clear on that. Apart from the introductory question that's asked by the poet, we're listening in verses 5 to 7 to the female character speaking. That's what's going on here. And let's have a quick look then at what she says. And particularly notice those powerful opening words of verse 6. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. Now, a seal in the ancient world was a physical mark that was placed on something or someone as a claim of ownership. It signified, this is mine. This belongs to me. That's what it signified when you placed a seal on something or someone. So the one doing the sealing then, that person was the owner, the possessor, while the one being sealed was the owned, the possessed. What's fascinating here in the first part of verse 6, however, is that the woman depicts her beloved as both, doesn't she? She refers to him setting a seal. Now that's what a possessor does. But then she also refers to him bearing the seal on his own heart and on his own arm. That's what the possessed does. And what she's getting at then is the idea that the two of them possess each other. She's saying, I am yours and you are mine. We own each other. We belong to each other. We are the possession of each other. That is what she's saying. And this notion of mutual possession, then, it sounds very intense, doesn't it? You might wonder whether she's being over the top and melodramatic. Does she perhaps need just to chill out a bit? Well, she's aware that there could be that kind of perception, and so she goes on to justify this language of ownership, this language of taking possession of each other. For, she continues, and these are the key words now in the whole of our text, love is strong. Love is strong. She's saying, I'm not being extreme here, talking in terms of mutual possession. No, this is just what love is. Love is this strong, vice-like grip that takes hold of its object and will not let go no matter what. Love doesn't mess about. Love doesn't dabble. Love doesn't toy. Love claims. Love clutches. Love takes possession unyieldingly. Love is strong. Indeed, notice how in the next line, she restates this idea that love is strong, but she now, as it were, gets out her thesaurus and replaces the words of the previous line with some synonyms. So, the grave instead of death. Now, we'll talk about that imagery later on, but suffice to say for now, the grave and death are synonyms. And then the adjective fierce instead of the adjective strong. And then, most interestingly of all, jealousy instead of love. What is jealousy? Well, jealousy is simply the passionate refusal to relinquish one's ownership. That's what jealousy is. If you're jealous about something, then you fight tooth and nail to hang on to it. And that can, of course, be a bad thing. When it's the kid who's clutching jealously the toy car, which actually belongs to all the children in the classroom, then jealousy there is a bad thing, but jealousy can also be a very good and a very healthy thing. This refusal to give up on something, and the woman here then is using that as a synonym for love. She's equating love with jealous ownership. She goes on in a similar vein to picture love as fire, the last part of verse 6. It makes me think of that scene that we've considered recently on a Sunday evening at the end of Genesis chapter 3. You remember the fall has happened and no one is now allowed into the Garden of Eden. And so you remember cherubim are stationed at the entrance to Eden, and they wield, we are told, a flaming sword, a sword of fire. And fire, then, is a security thing there in Genesis 3. It keeps Eden out of bounds to Adam and Eve and anyone else who might ever try to get in. And love is fire in the same sense. Love keeps its object secure and out of bounds. If anyone or anything tries to steal away the loved one, love burns against that person. It burns against that thing. It burns against that threat. You're getting the picture, I hope. Love, our text is saying, is not a mood. It's not a whim. It's not a feeling. It's not a chemistry. It's not a gratifying of desires. Love is vastly, vastly stronger than that. And the woman concludes in the last part of verse 7 that this is what makes love so special and so valuable. The fact that it's this strong, jealous, unrelinquishing thing, a man and a woman possessing each other. It's more valuable, she says there, than all the wealth of a man's house. And these remarks then of the woman here on the nature of love, they give rise, I think, to a couple of points of application. So first of all, surely we must say this, how necessary these emphases are in our present context today. How necessary. We live, don't we, in a consumerist society, perhaps the most consumerist society that the world has ever seen. And relationships are often conducted on that consumerist basis. They are maintained for as long as is convenient and easy. And during that time then, a man and a woman may live together, they may even have kids together, but then after a while they find the relationship is no longer convenient and easy, and so it's dispensed with. Ultimately, it's a throwaway thing. If it works, then great, but the reality is it might not. As a character says in the song by Adele, sometimes it lasts in love, sometimes it hurts instead. And our passage is saying to that character in the Adele song, no, what you're talking about there is not love, because love is strong. Love is tenacious and dogged. Love is two persons taking an irreversible and exclusive and highly vigilant ownership of each other. Love doesn't give things a go for a few years, hoping it will work out. No, love is binding. That's what our text is saying. And listening then to the music and watching the films of our culture today, we can easily, even as Christians, become fuzzy in our thinking about these matters. And that's what I mean by my first heading this morning, a delightful clarity. There's a delightful clarity in our text as to what love is. And we need that clarity to sweep away all the fog that our culture may have caused to creep into our minds. We need this clarity to throw into sharp relief for us again that love is mutual possession of the most unbreakable kind. And let me just add, our passage clarifies too that that is the context in which sexual relations are proper and meaningful. We're meant to understand that this woman comes up from the wilderness, verse 5, that most private of locations, leaning on her beloved because the two of them have been intimate together there. There are evidences for that in the text, which I won't go into just now. But that then is proper and it's meaningful because they are this husband and wife who have taken possession of each other. Do you remember I said a few months ago now in our Sunday evening series, when preaching from the very last verses of Genesis chapter 2, I said that the whole purpose of sex is to symbolize and express and depict that binding together of two lives. And it's so appropriate, therefore, that she emerges from their time together in the wilderness, waxing lyrical about a permanent and exclusive bond that they have together. Our society has tragically severed those two things, hasn't it? It's severed sex from a permanent and exclusive bond. Sex is simply about recreation and fun and freedom in our society, which immeasurably cheapens it and eviscerates it and turns it into the disappointing, unsatisfying idol that it has become. No, it's about a permanent and exclusive bond. That's where it's rich and special and precious and meaningful. And so I'm saying then, in these kinds of areas, let's not get befuddled in our thinking by our confused society all around us. Let's be clear on these things which our passage gives us such clarity on. So that's one point of application. And then the other point of application is this: some aspects of our passage have relevance beyond just marriage. Some aspects of our passage have relevance beyond just marriage. This concept that we're thinking about this morning, that love is strong, yes, our text has in mind marital love. That's what the Song of Solomon is all about, of course. But love, if it is truly love, is always actually distinguished by this quality of unbreakable strength, whether or not it's marital love. So you think of 1 Corinthians 13, that we read earlier this morning. And that passage, I guess, today often is read at weddings, but it's not about marital love. It's not remotely about marital love. Paul is writing to a church whose members are basically in competition with each other as to who possesses the best spiritual gifts. And there are folk in that church who can speak in tongues. And they think that they are it. They are the elite of Corinth Evangelical Church. And they gloat then to the others in the fellowship who don't speak in tongues. While those who don't speak in tongues look upon this elite with envy and wish that they were part of it. And Paul then is writing that letter to them, and he's writing that section of the letter to them, and he's saying to them, do you know what? I don't care about your tongue speaking. God doesn't care about your tongue speaking either. You may be the most spiritually gifted of all the first century churches, so what? It means nothing. It's neither here nor there. The thing that I care about as an apostle, the thing that God in heaven cares about, is your relationships, your love for one another, and on that point, you're failing miserably. That's why Paul writes 1 Corinthians 13 with its list there of loves, attributes. He writes it in order to sober and correct this gift-obsessed congregation. He writes it in order to rearrange their priorities. I'm saying the passage, it's not designed for a wedding on a Saturday and for a couple standing at the front. It's designed for a service on the Lord's Day and for church members sitting in their seats. It's telling us how we should love the other people in this room. And do you remember then that one of love's attributes listed in that passage is this, verse 8, love never ends, as it is in the ESV. Perhaps better, love never fails. Love never fails. And the previous line is in a similar vein, love endures all things. And it's that strength then, isn't it, that our text is talking about. That strength that genuine love has. But there in 1 Corinthians 13, it's been applied not to marriage relationships, but to church relationships. And it's confronting us then with the question this morning, whether or not we're married, it's confronting all of us with the question, do we love each other in this church like that? With a strong love, a tenacious love, a love that doesn't fail. Sometimes someone in the church may say something to you that is reckless and unnecessary. That can happen. Sometimes someone in the church may ignore you and overlook you. That can happen. I'm asking, do you have a love that is strong and able to weather those kinds of storms and absorb those kinds of blows that won't unravel in the face of some provocation? That's true love. And perhaps indeed we can transfer the last part of our text this morning to this non-marital love that we're now talking about. Remember how the last part of our text, the last part of verse 7, it describes the incomparable value of strong, unfailing love. It's more valuable, the woman says, than all the wealth of a man's house. So for a married couple then, the text is primarily saying, for a married couple, it's way better to have strong love that doesn't fail than to live in a mansion with a Lamborghini on the drive. But I'm saying we can transfer this, I think, into the realm of our church relationships as well. It's way better to be a church that has strong bonds of love between each other than to be a church that has lots of money and a big staff and cutting-edge technology coming out of its ears. Pursue love, Paul concludes that whole passage in the first verse of chapter 14. Pursue love. That's an exhortation for us this morning. Pursue love. That love that does not fail. That love that is strong. That love that can absorb blows and provocations and little bumps in the relationships. That strong love that's so conspicuous here in our text, in Song of Solomon 8, may we as a church pursue that. So, a delightful clarity, and we've seen then how clear our passage is on the strength of love and a couple of applications from that. A delightful clarity, but secondly this morning, a dubious comparison. A dubious comparison. So think then of things which take hold of something or someone and won't let go. I used earlier the term vice-like, and that's a reference then, of course, to that implement that you might get in a tool shed, in a working environment where woodwork is going on, metalwork is going on. You might get a vice, and it clamps then a piece of wood or a piece of metal in a stable position so that it can be hammered, it can be sawed, and it won't move. A vice is a good example of something that grips with inescapable strength. Or you think of that rocket last October, which took off from Texas, and once it was outside the Earth's atmosphere, the booster that was no longer required separated from the rest of the rocket and it came back down. But on this occasion, it didn't, like normal, come down in the ocean. Instead, do you remember, you probably saw the images on your TV screens. Instead, Elon Musk's team had devised this huge tower with two mechanical arms coming out of it, and these mechanical arms, astonishingly, they grabbed hold of this descending booster. It was descending at eye-watering speeds, flames coming out of it, but these two arms, they grabbed hold of this booster mid-air, and they held onto it tightly. Another good example, then, of something that grips tenaciously. Or you think of addictions. Matthew Perry, the actor in Friends, who died a couple of years ago, age 54. He attended 6,000 AA meetings. He had therapy for 30 years, 15 rehabs, in detox 65 times, 14 surgeries. His addictions to drink and drugs, they had him in their unrelenting clutches. I'm saying there are all these different things, aren't there, that grip hold tightly. Now, when Song of Solomon was written, a vice probably hadn't been invented yet. Certainly there were no rockets being propelled into space so that the booster could fall back down and be caught hold of, and addictions weren't the thing that they are today. But the point I'm making is, surely this woman, looking out in the world, surely she could have thought of something with which to compare love, something more suitable than the comparison that she does make. Because what is the comparison that she does make? There in the middle of verse 6, love, she says, is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. And you might be thinking, well, Dan, that's a great comparison. Death, after all, takes hold of people like nothing else does. I mean, forget vices and mechanical arms and addictions. They're all flimsy alongside death. Fair play to this woman for thinking of something that's really, really strong and using that as her comparison. But you see, the problem with her using death as her comparison is that actually death is too strong, isn't it? So that what she says here in the middle of verse 6 actually isn't true. Love, she says, is strong as death. Well, no, it isn't. It isn't. You think of a husband and wife, and the husband loves his wife with the kind of love that we've been talking about this morning, and his love grips her tightly, and over the years and the decades that they're married, nothing can prize her from him, but then eventually death comes along, and it takes her from him. And there's nothing he can do. Death has an even stronger, more unyielding grip than his love for her does. Jealousy, verse 6 continues, is fierce as the grave. Well, no, it isn't. It isn't. Jealousy can be that protective fire that we talked about earlier, so that any rival trying to steal your beloved is burned and gives up trying to steal your beloved. But jealousy won't deter the grave. The grave will pass through the flames of your jealousy like they aren't there, and will steal away your beloved regardless. And so you see what I mean about this dubious comparison. Any other strong thing would work fine as a comparison and would indeed serve to highlight the strength of love. But the woman here, she chooses the one strong thing in the world that actually exposes love's weakness. The one strong thing that leaves love pathetically and tragically impotent. The one strong thing that breaks love's chains and defies love's tenacity. The one strong thing which mocks love and says to love, you've held on to your object unrelentingly for all these years, but I'm taking hold of him or her now, and you can't do anything about it. And it raises the question then, why do we get here in Song of Solomon 8 verse 6 such a dubious comparison? Is this just a piece of crass thoughtlessness on the part of the woman? Why does she go for death? It seems so cruel that that's the comparison she chooses, this one thing which exposes love's weakness. Because love can't grip hold of its object in the face of death. And yet that's the comparison of all comparisons that she goes for. Well, I think we need to probe here. The last two lines of verse 6 are interesting, aren't they? Its flashes, so love's flashes or jealousy's flashes, are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord, of Yahweh. Now, most translations don't refer to the Lord there. They don't refer to Yahweh. The thinking is that it would be out of place, seeing as he hasn't been mentioned at all in this entire book. And we like to be able to reel off that piece of Bible trivia that, you know, Esther doesn't mention God and Song of Solomon doesn't mention God. And so this rather spoils that if God is in fact mentioned here in this verse. And so it's assumed then that that Yahweh here in the Hebrew text, it must just be being used to kind of convey something like mighty. And so a mighty flame is all that is being said here. I think that's very, very unlikely indeed, given how special the divine name Yahweh is in the Old Testament. I think the word Elohim, God, is sometimes used in that way just to mean something like mighty or almighty, but Yahweh, I very much doubt it. It's too special to be used to mean anything other than Yahweh, the one true and living God. And so I think the ESV is right to translate it in this way here. And the point is then that when in human marriage you see love being protective and burning against something that threatens that marriage, the text is saying there's something of Yahweh in that. There's something of Yahweh in those fiery flames of jealousy that sometimes you see in a human marriage. Because that's what he's like. He's a jealous lover. He's intensely possessive regarding the objects of his love. His love is not a casual, indifferent thing. It's a strong love. A love that grips tightly. His love for the elect. His love for his people. His love for you and me is that kind of love. A jealous love, a strong love, a tenacious love, a possessive love. That's how he loves us. And all of this means then that Yahweh's love is somewhere, at least in this woman's mind, as she speaks the words of verse 6. That's clear from the way the verse ends. And perhaps that can explain how she can say, love is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. Perhaps in the last analysis, that's not a dubious, crass, cruel comparison. Because actually there is a love as strong as death. There is a love that clutches its object so ferociously that even death can't interfere with it. God's love is like that. There is a jealousy so searingly hot that even death gets burned if it comes too close to it and has to retreat. God's jealousy, God's love for us, God's jealousy regarding you and me. And I want to close then saying to you this morning, Christian believer, please understand this. Please understand this. Death is able to take your loved ones out of your clutches. That's a sad fact, but it's true. Your love cannot match death for strength. But death is emphatically not able to take you out of God's clutches. Death is not able to take you out of God's clutches. This is Sunday, the Lord's Day, the day that celebrates that Sunday 2,000 years ago when God, through the resurrection of Jesus, defeated death. God subdued death that day. God brought death to heal that day. Which means that death cannot even remotely now dislodge a person from God's love once God's love has taken hold of a person. All death can do, in fact, is bring us nearer to God, usher us into his presence. I'm saying God's love, God is never bereaved of his loved ones. He doesn't watch them slip away into the possession of death, like we watch our loved ones slip away into the possession of death. God never has to sadly visit their graves, wishing he could have them back. No, God's love is stronger than death. Your love, I said, it cannot match death for strength. God's love is the other way round. Death cannot match it for strength. Death cannot match it for strength. What a thing to be loved by this God who simply will not let go of you. Not even in that moment when you breathe your last, he will not let go of you. You will still be in his clutches, and he will bring you through death and out the other side safely to be with him forever and ever. What a thing that God's love does fit the terms of this text. It's not hyperbole. It is in relation to you and me. Our love isn't strong as death. But there is a love that is stronger than death, and that is God's love. Do you know that love this morning? Perhaps some of you have never experienced that. And that love invites you this morning to come and be embraced by it. Come and trust in Jesus Christ, the death conqueror, and you will be able to sink into the grip of a love that will never let you go. What a God. What a lover. What a privilege is ours to be loved by this God. May he bless his word to us. Amen. We're going to